Good evening, everybody. Gosh, that's very impressive. You don't normally listen like that. Well, we have a treat this evening with Paul Robertson. Paul and I go back a long way, and as he mentioned, there was a time when both of us... That actually is untrue. There was a time when Paul was intensely interested in how music affected the brain. And I really wasn't all that interested. Because I couldn't really see at that point that the technology was sufficiently developed to be able to push it forward. However, he rang me up and said, "How does it affect the brain?" I said, "I don't really know. Have a nice day, Paul." He rang me up the next day and said, "Have you thought about it?" And I could see there was going to be no end to this. And so I did exactly what he told me and looked it up. And then we went through a really nice phase together when we were looking at the current advances in medical imaging, medical science, and how brain and music seemed to come together. In fact, we gave a talk about this, if you remember. And you have to remember that my musical knowledge is not terribly good, but I have got grade 2 piano, if it's...
more than I've got.
Well, just in case any of you want a pianist... we gave a talk at College House, and it was about music and the brain, but it was done in a sonata form. Now, I had no idea what a sonata form was, but Paul helped out with ABBA, and I reckoned I could actually cope with that. And so the talk was fashioned that way, and they all liked it, so that was great. Now, one of my interests, as you know, has been near-death experiences. And one of Paul's experiences has been near-death experiences. And as you know, excuse me, as you know, he was very ill. And there are a whole lot of lessons that I think myself as a medical practitioner, indeed any of us, can gain from this. One of which is that the brain is very plastic. And one of the things I remember that he said to me was, my physician says I'll never play the violin again. And then he looked at me, and I knew that he'd absolutely no intention of taking any advice along those lines at all. And this is why it's important to remain that the brain is plastic. And if you work at it, you can actually change things. And particularly if you've had skills before. So the important thing is to interact and get things going again. Paul has done just that, which is magnificent. The other point which is interesting to me is that anybody who has reached that level of consciousness that you can do in the near-death experience is changed by it. And your creativity is altered. And the way that you respond to other people, to your friends, and the way that you progress in your own development also changes. And I think, and Chika will tell me if I'm correct, that this has happened with Paul as well. I think that he's developed whole new facets to himself that would not have been there had he A, not struggled, and B, not had the near-death experience. So if you take somebody who was initially very talented, and you remember that he led the Medici Quartet and played internationally and nationally, and I've got a nice lot of records, which I got from Paul, and the highlight for Paul's playing, as far as I was concerned, was when he was doing the late Bach Quartet, Beethoven Quartets, sorry, my music, absolutely magical. And he shows in those recordings an insight that you just can't get in other recordings. So if they're still available, that's certainly something that you should need. So, Paul, it's such a pleasure to have you back here.
Thank you.
And I know what it means for you to come out and do an event like this. I also understand that one has limited energy. And so Paul has absolute freedom to put his violin down at any point and say, I'm going home. And we'll say, great, but you've got that far. So I'd like you all to welcome Paul Robertson.
Well, as ever, Peter makes a far more and beautiful exponent of my dubious virtues than is in any way justified. And listening to Satish's talk earlier, I realised that I'm probably as far from a pilgrim by personality as a person can be, since I never had either humility or trust in the least degree. With the possible exception, from time to time, within the area of my gift, talent. And maybe that's what a talent is. It's just your one shot at that. That's what it feels like to me. And just about this evening, I have to tell you that I've actually changed the title of the talk, rather radically, actually. And that was as a result of having a conversation with Martin over there. The late lamented Terry Pratchett, his greatest character in his books, as many of you all know, is death. And death speaks in capital letters all the time and is very humorous and doleful, as you'd imagine. Well, Martin is not is better looking than death. He delivers devastating lines in much the same fashion, although all of his lines are in lower case. And he did one the other night for me because I thought I better just check what exactly I'm doing here and what's expected. So I call him up perfectly innocently and I said, Martin, when am I on? How long am I doing? And what's the expectation? He said, well, you're on after dinner. And I said, and what do you think everyone's really expecting? And he said, an after-dinner entertainment. It would be nice to think that was a joke, but I don't think it was. So humility is something that I'm being sent in large gobbets nowadays, or the need for it, and that was one such. So I've actually altered the title of my talk, which now reads, I've been writing a book for the last 7 years, since I've been ill, and the main issue I have is not that I can't get the ideas down, but I can't get them down in a form that anyone else finds comprehensible. I think they're great. So this talk is now entitled, Infamous Sex Fiend Churchman Was Cross-Dressing Paedophile Claims Dodgy Psychic. So, you want it again, do you? You do understand that the talk itself is completely unchanged.
Okay.
Infamous sex fiend churchman was cross-dressing paedophile claims dodgy psychic. And I'm not going to do it all at once, but during the course of this talk, if you stay alert sufficiently, each of those statements is justified, as you'll see. Well, Bach was a churchman, was he not? Well, I think he was. He was cantor of St. Thomas's, and so on. So each of those. And I'll just get out the cross-dressing bit. Well, we know he was cross-dressing because there's hardly a portrait of him where he's not wearing a wig. And a dress coat. Well, I mean, need I say more? You know, so, now, I'm going to tell you this. Some of you will have heard this before, but it has a peculiar possible relevance. My a little incident that happened to me when I was young, which I'm sure bent the whole shape of my life completely out of any normal formation. But I think I'm already in good company here about that. I don't mean that rudely, by the way. That's meant to, for me, that's a compliment. When I discovered the violin, we were really quite poor, relatively poor. We'd only just moved out of a caravan for the first time, and we were in a little house, and my mum and dad had no money, and my poor dad sold his beloved van to give me violin lessons. And a year in, the violin teacher said, you know, he's really very talented, and he needs a decent instrument. I know a person who could, I know a good English maker, it will cost £80. And £80 was an absolute fortune then, and I can't quite think when then would have been, so I would have been 52, 62, about 1962. And it was way more money than we had. And my darling dad, who was such a lovely man, said, look, Paul, we haven't got the money. There's nothing I can do. He said, the only thing I could suggest is if you want, you could fill in this week's football pools. And for reasons I still don't understand in any ordinary sense, I took this very seriously. And I was learning a Mozart violin concerto at the time. And I made a simple code which translated each note of the score into a number. And those are the numbers I chose as the score draws. And it came up and we won £80. See? So you can imagine from then on, apart from whatever the reality of my life is, and we don't really know the reality of our own lives, but I've always perceived myself as being A, a very fortunate person, and B, someone who receives miracles on a regular basis. And to be honest, until I was about 35, and even since, that's exactly what has happened to me. There's certainly no merit in it, but it's hard not to, you know. So with Bach, I was one of those composers who I found intensely difficult. What I found most difficult about it was I sensed that there was a huge body of meaning in it. I sensed that partly because the players who I most admired, and I only had access to Radio 3, Menuhin and Milstein and all the other greats, all seemed to devote serious amounts of time to playing solo Bach. And let's face it, and we can be honest here, violin, the solo violin pieces particularly, can be pretty grating on the nerves. They just can. They're not everyone's cup of tea. They can be boring, they can be monotonous, very dull, very complicated, hard to understand, and yet I recognised there was something, if only I could get to it. So I had to wait till I was enough of a violinist to approach it, and when I was about 14 or 15, my teacher said, okay, you've been learning, and I was very, my word, I was devoted. I did 4 hours practice from the age of 8, every day, religiously. And he only gave me scales for the first 2 years, so he was quite disciplined. He said, I think you can choose, this was a great honour, you can choose what you learn next. First time I'd had that opportunity. And I said, oh, I want to learn some solo Bach. And he looked absolutely gobsmacked. And he said, you do know that the unaccompanied Bach sonatas are just exercises for the violin. And I said, no, I don't know that. I don't feel that's true. I feel there's something more to them than that. I want to understand them. So rather grudgingly, he told me which edition to buy, and I went away and I started trying to learn one of the relatively accessible ones and could not make head nor tail of it. And I went back close to tears the next week, and he got very angry. He was a fine violinist, by the way, a really fine man and a fine violinist. He got very angry, and he said, you know, you're going about this all the wrong way. Bach should be played in the same way that a typist types on a typewriter. Play the notes, and the music will speak for itself. Now, I have to say, now at the other end of my own life, I could see truth in what he said. and I begin to understand maybe what he was saying. But he was not a Bach player. He was a wonderful player, but he was not a Bach player. And as he said those words, I remember, it was actually like an optical delusion. I saw him shrink physically. This great man who, and he came back to being a great man in a way, but never quite as great as that day in that moment, when suddenly he went like, suddenly in Alice in Wonderland, I saw him at the far end of the wrong end of the telescope. It was a little squeaking man who was wrong. And I went home and I tried again myself. And I found the score I had then, some years ago. And to my surprise and interest, I'd written over some of the movements things like the Garden of Gethsemane and the Passion and things like that. But I couldn't get into it. It was completely impenetrable. Then in the early 2000s, about 2002 or so, I had the great good fortune to be given a fellowship from NESTA, which was is the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts. It was a very, very, very generous, a three-year fellowship. And the only injunction was that they would accept any application I made as long as I could define or describe what I needed to do to make even greater access to my own creativity. I mean, that's not so bad, is it? And as soon as they said that, instantly I knew what I wanted to do, was to spend 3 years with the solo Bachs. And by enormous good fortune, we'll have to say that's what it was, I started working on them, and I became, and had been always fascinated by the fact that Bach is a master of counterpoint, that is many-voiced music, the master of counterpoint. So why would he choose to write some of his most contrapuntal music for an instrument that inherently can only play one note at a time? That's borderline perverse. It's also, unfortunately, that's what makes it so jolly hard. So I felt convinced then that the implication was that this was music where the greater part of the music was not designed to be heard explicitly. Therefore, the player, or you the listener, or us the listener, have to fill in the unseen world, which felt very much like life generally to me. So I started work, and I did a lot of work with a eurythmist. We ended up with something I thought was quite beautiful, because I felt convinced that that eurythmy would be able to actually make explicit the secret language, the secret meaning of the music. And the man who was married to the eurythmist I was working with was also an esotericist. This was pure chance, by the way. I didn't even know them until I rang them up and got started. And blow me, he was in touch with someone called Helga Turner, a German, I suppose you'd call her an academic, but she's an esoteric academic, if there is such a thing, who had just finally published a decoding of these pieces, which is, and some of you will have heard me speak of this, and I'm going to speak very briefly about this indeed. But basically what she'd revealed, and certainly to my satisfaction, proven, was that Bach, at this period, and in only these works, they're probably elsewhere too, but very much in these works, had actually hidden a whole personal pantheon, which was both his personal faith, because at this time he was aged 32, by the way, 1720. He was married, this is the paedophilia bit, he was married to Maria Barbara, who was a beloved wife, I think they already had 8 children, who he married when she was just 15. Shock horror. That's what everyone did then, of course. Tragically, as master of the court orchestra, which was Duke Leopold of Curtin, Leopold told him that he wanted only secular music. Well, composers were servants in those days. So the master, the man whose whole dedication of his life was to write what he called a complete church music, from which we can only believe or understand that he meant he wanted to be able to compose a work that celebrated every single event of the Lutheran church calendar, which is one hell of a lot of events. It's a mass of music every day of the year. And he succeeded, although some, sadly about a third of it's lost. So there he was with this immense devout compulsion, being obliged to write secular music. He did pretty well. He was a great man. He wrote the Brandenburg Concertos at exactly the same time. And they seem to have lasted quite successfully. And then he got taken away as the director of the orchestra on a three-month trip to one of the spa towns with the Duke, and he had to leave Maria behind. And remember, this was pre-telephone, any form of communication. 3 months later, he returns, and to imagine, Maria, has he discovers, has died in childbirth just a few weeks before. And imagine the mayhem of his life, apart from anything else. Yes, she was dead and buried, gone. So he sits down, and this we know, within the 2 to 3 days of this, he's sitting down to write the D minor partita, which is an encoded celebration of his belief in the resurrection and his love for his wife. And it's a... Well, even before the codes were discovered, the D minor is the one with the great chaconne, which I played once for the society here. Well, Brahms described it, he said of it, we're rattling over here. Can you hear it, Martin?
Yeah. Has anybody got a mobile phone switched on?
Us, probably. Where was I? Thank you, yes. So, literally whilst there's all these children and goodness only knows what chaos, he's sitting down and he's writing at a level of multiple encoding a work of celebration of his faith. The whole of the creed is there. There are multiple hidden chorales, Lutheran chorales, as there are in all of these works. And most particularly, and very most particularly in the D minor, there's a numerology of exactly the same kind that I did when I was 8 or 10. It was called a naive Latin gematria, which is the conversion of notes to number. And the accumulation of notes add up to sacred numbers. And a lot of the numbers, I mean, again, I won't possibly go through all of this lot, but because it's paid, I mean, this is a big work of great scholarship and a life's work. In fact, she didn't want to publish, and Menuhin persuaded her, because she realised that the poor lady, she was likely to get drummed out of academic life for publishing something so esoteric, even though it's true. So, for example, so you understand the note A has the numerological number of 1, B, 2, C, 3, so on and so forth, but it's a Latin alphabet, so the numbers don't quite add up in English. So BACH, of course, which is very potent for obvious reasons. BACH, I should explain, is Bach's name, obviously his name, but it's B flat, A, C, B natural, which I'll play in a moment. And that totals 14. And then because it's a Kabbalistic system, it's a Jewish system, basically, which is also very surprising. There are lots of tricks that are accepted within a Kabbalistic gematria, where, for example, you reverse the numbers and they retain the same meaning. So 41 as well as 14 has a 10, they read both ways. Yoseb, which is how he signed himself, Bach equals 80, Maria Barbara is 81, and so on and so forth. And there are various beautiful, what should we call them, things that he read as synchronicities. So, for example, the divinely inspired musician of the Old Testament, which is King David, adds up to 14. So he associated with David. And in fact, Bach's Bible has been discovered, and it appears to be annotated in his hand. And sure enough, he circled all those numerological names. And next to the references of David, he says, "This justifies the musician in the face of God." Because remember, this is a Lutheran tradition. Singing, dancing, enjoying yourself was not kind of big on the agenda. And as for using Jewish Kabbalism, even then he would have got thrown out of the church had he been discovered. But we know that one of Bach's closest friends was a Jewish dancing master. And the dance suites, and again, thinking about your connection with dance and meaning and faith, as you know, all the dance suites, and these ones particularly, are riddled with religious symbolism. I mean, it's structured, and you can see the magic, and there are magic chords at magic moments. It's like a exposition of the esoteric. Very beautiful, very beautiful. All designed not to be heard. I'm sure it was designed to be an act of devotion there. And I personally rather suspect that it was probably also designed to be enjoyed by a little tiny coterie, like effectively an esoteric school, that almost certainly had the Jewish dancing master and Picander, who was the man who wrote all the words for most of the Bach cantatas, which, by the way, are highly erotic. They're really out there. And the reason is that the fashion then, and what was perfectly acceptable, was as long as it came from the Bible, so they tended to focus on the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, which is highly erotic. So the mystic union between Christ and his church, or man and God, finds a fleshly, which is the metaphor, is up to us to choose, I guess. But it's all there. And there's no accident that he's celebrating his love for his wife, because it was on the dance floor that he and Maria Barbara, and anyone of a respectable Lutheran world, would have had their only moments of contact before marriage, when under the eye of umpteen chaperones, their fingers were allowed to touch as they did these immensely complex and beautiful Baroque dancing. And the Baroque dances, blow me, extended the project to include Baroque dance. In the Baroque dance world, there's at exactly the same esoteric patterning. It is the very heart of the Baroque. And one of the big issues, or one of the beauties of the Baroque, which we see when we go into a Baroque church, is what you might call asymmetric symmetries, which is where we will perceive things as being balanced and shaped and equal, but actually when you look closely, all the detail is either running in reverse or is subtly different, and that's the masculine-feminine principle. And very often on the really fine churches, you can follow this like a metaphoric gender exposition around you. It's really, so you're literally in the body of human love. Enough. I must stop frothing about Bach. Why? Well, because you can carry on forever. Let me just illustrate. Now, and it's interesting because, again, it came up very much with what you were talking about, David. I'll just illustrate, as it seems to me, part of what creates the transcendent quality. Now, there was a debate in the Times recently, I don't know if anyone saw it, about whether music could be inherently spiritual or religious, and whether that related to the faith of the composer or lack of it. In this case, there's no real doubt about his faith. How does that come across? Well, we know about the coding. I think it comes across at many different levels. One is the immense capacity Bach and the other greats of the Western pantheon have of creating structures into which the player and the music becomes a mere instrument. In other words, you cannot step out of the great play. And whilst you're observed in that great, whilst you're absorbed into that great play, you are in a transcendent condition because you are participating in something far greater than only yourself, clearly. So, for example, this is only a small example, and it's probably the beginning of one of the chorales. I can't remember the detail. I'm going to try and play as much of the sonata as I can manage this evening. Don't worry about this yet. So the slow movement of the sonata that opens it begins with a fairly disguised but fairly traditional falling. And it sounds as, now you really have to pin your ears back. So you've had. Can you hear it? Can you? Don't say yes if you can't. It's meant to be. Okay? So there's this falling, in fact it's actually a bass line, but because of the restriction of how the range of the instrument, you can't go down and down and down. So it starts low, and then it simply goes up the octave, but the same progression is actually falling. So what you're hearing, jumping octaves, is. I'll try and pick them out. You hear it now? Yeah. Now, that's very typical of the. This means that you actually. Despite the fantastic quality, the improvised quality of this, there's this noble, magnificent, cosmic shape that you're arabesquing around something that is much bigger than the arabesque itself. That's just a little illustration of that movement. The next one I just love because I think I may have discovered this as twere all on my own. The next one is a completely impossible to play fugue, which is why I'm rather nervous about trying it today. And it's got a very significant reference to his name. So his name in notes is this, B A C H. That's the German for B natural. Now in music you can transpose notes, and they still retain their meaning. So you hear those intervals, dee-da-dee-dum. In this case, one appears. You hear that it's the same basic motif. Okay, now what he does is he places that in what's called a tierce de Picardy. And a tierce, this is, forgive me, for those who know harmony, it's real simple stuff. But it's not if you don't. A tierce de Picardy is when you change a minor chord at the last moment to a major resolution. And it sounds like this. So your minor, major, but the heart of it. Now, this is the accompanying sonata, which is a more formal structure that goes with the D minor partita, which is a dance suite. Therefore, we know it's about Easter, we know it's about the resurrection, we know it's about spring, new birth. So he's placing himself at the point of the resurrection. Now, what's so wonderful to me is he creates this... oh, how people write fugues, I don't know. There is a chap here who does. You? No, who is it? Somebody I was talking to who writes fugues on a daily basis. I'm in awe. He writes this whole fugue, apparently about something else completely. He never restates his own name till the very last four notes, which is a culmination. It goes, in this case... within the limits of the instrument, that is such a triumphant statement, and it's Bach. He really believes. Now, that's transcendent. I have to hope that I can feel something like it when I come to play it. But you do understand that so there is this stuff in music. Here's another movement, the third movement, which is very slight. This is a different form of exquisitely remorseless patterning, again, which you referred to, we saw in the dance. This one is very obvious, it's a rhythmic one. So that kind of tread, a noble tread, spacious tread. Well, once it starts, it's Bach, so it actually allows himself to stop midpoint, but that's one of those sacred points. And then it starts again, and it unwinds going backwards. Well, once you're onto a tread like that, then you are again once part of something so much greater than yourself. And the last movement, which is, well, can be taken in many ways. It's pure Baroque. It's also very theatric in one sense. And he marks in the dynamics, that's the loudness and softnesses, as the device that was terribly popular at the time, which was echoing. But echoing, of course, you understand, could be male or female too, without having to say which is which. So, and it's quite exaggerated. So on. Now, I've chosen to be, or gonna, if I get that far, God willing, to be quite literal. For reasons that are not at all clear, the second half, vast part, about 90% of it, is the assertive one, but it finishes with this little feminine ending, which is... So, what is the movement really about? I think that's left completely... it's just there for you. What? It's so against the instinct of... Well, certainly of the Romantics, where normally you know, something triumphant. No, but to finish, the triumph is... something quite amazing. Anyway, I waffled on enough about that one. Maybe I should try and play some. Can I shunt this aside now? Thank you. However far I get, as long as I've got the energy, I'll tell you a little bit about my understanding of how it is that a violin or an instrument and the pursuit of an instrument can be a metaphor of some kind of enlightenment. But I'll try and play first. If I stop and pant between movements, it's not written in.
Thank you. Thank you.
Probably about the first time I played for a year.
Yes, amazing.
Something like that.
The energy from everyone.
Yeah, that does make all the difference. Thank you so much. Very kind of you. I would love to have some questions, but if you wished, I could just say a little tiny bit about the path of being a musician. Because this is what my book is about. What I found is that the more I work on it, and a lot of the material is actually drawn from the bizarre visions, whatever they were, I had in coma, and then trying to sort of sew them together into threads. And the threads of late have become more and more one thread, and they may finally become a single thread, I don't know. So... there's a section where I've tried to describe my... everyone has to have at least a musical mentor in the same way as you might have a spiritual one, or I did have a spiritual one. My mentor was a wonderful pianist called Clifford Curzon, who... I mean, he's the only person who's now dead who I truly miss. I really miss him. Although I'm sure he's waiting somewhere. And he used to speak, he spoke of many things. But he used to speak of something which he called the second simplicity. He pointed out that gifted musicians, probably all gifted musicians, have the experience from time to time where they take a piece which is new to them and they sight read it and it's perfect. They then take it away and it takes them months or years to get back to the point where they did it the first time. And he thought that that was the journey back was the whole art of arts, of being a musician and in being an interpreter. And the more I've thought about it, I realise that that experience involves a huge amount of letting go. And letting go is so fundamental on the violin. I'm sure it's fundamental in life generally, but I only know it on the violin, or have glimpses. So, for example, and this sounds terrible, I'll start at a really mechanistic level. A friend of mine was doing work measuring the calorific expenditure of people playing the piano. Which is considerable, by the way. So somebody giving a piano recital, a full-scale piano recital, shifts in just their hands and fingers, the actual movement, the equivalent of shoveling about 1.5 tons of coal. But one of the things he noticed, he measured this because he was especially a doctor specialising in repetitive strain injury, which sadly is a very typical syndrome for lots of musicians, curiously tied up with their psychology as well as their technique, of course. But one of the things he measured and was consistent was that amateurs used about somewhere between 10 and 30 times more effort to play the same group of notes as a top-class professional. Yeah. And in the violin, I know that also to be true. I had a friend who... had the great privilege of sitting in the orchestra right next to Heifetz, who was the god of the violin world, when he made possibly his most single famous recording, which was the Scottish Fantasy, Brook. And he said, it was very interesting, the conductor on that record is Malcolm Sargent. Nobody looked at Malcolm Sargent once. Most people can't remember who the conductor was because it doesn't matter. And the string section were just, they sat there mesmerised by this, you know, one of those rare occasions where somebody just seemed to belong in another league again, even above the geniuses. And he said all the way through the whole session, he had this feeling that if he'd gone across to Heifetz and gone like that, the violin would have blown out of his hands. He was barely holding it. And the sound, oh, Heifetz's sound, searing, it just cuts you to the very... You know. And of course, that aspect of letting go, everything on the violin is to do with letting go, to draw the bow, to make a shift. If you over-control it, if you try and control it, it's death. It's like trying to walk with a wooden leg. You know, it cannot be like that. It has to be in flow and it has to be let go of. This is really tempting fate. There's a little exercise, my favourite single exercise for starting practice, which is to play an up bow, I don't know if you can see, where you don't hold the bow with the thumb. Well, whilst you don't have the thumb in opposition, I can assure you there ain't no pressure. You know, that's got to be the starting place, and it's the same on the other hand. Everything has to be just completely loose and flexible. So what we perceive, and I'm sure it's related to this what we perceive very often, we misconstrue the impulse, the incisiveness of what we hear, which is an act of the imagination and the will. And we mistake that, because we're all amateurs at life, we mistake that for somebody really... It's got nothing to do with that, ever. And of course, at a psychological and a more metaphoric level, the same is true of this first simplicity. Of course you do the work. You do the work, and Curzon was a master. The first piece we learnt with him was the Dvorak Piano Quintet, and I was about 22. And I love Curzon. He was a wicked old bastard, and I loved him. And he would do things on the piano, and he'd do them over and over again, and he'd melt my heart, and he'd see me, he'd move me to tears. There's a chord at the beginning of the slow movement of the Dvorak, which is just a broken chord. He could play that in such a way that every time he did it, I was unmanned. And I remember one day, because we were rehearsing in his studio, and I was standing over in the corner, and he was very short-sighted, and he was a most undemonstrative man in many ways, and he was apparently practicing this section. And I suddenly realised, wicked devil, he was glancing over at me. For the moment when I was really not attending and I was having a conversation with Elsa, and he'd suddenly go, and he'd watch me go. But the beauty of this second simplicity is that you have to let go of all the things you learn. All the analysis, all the process has to be let go of. But the beauty of it, and I don't know whether this is true in your life, as you would say, is that the patina of the things that you're not referring to remain. So that the simplicity is then enriched in a way that could never have been the first time round. Well, that's just a little example. The same process, as far as I can tell, happens big time when it comes to, say, shuffle off the mortal coil and you let go. By heck, you let go. And in my case, as Chica knows, and I've made no bones about it, and that's why I may be a different person, but I'm not necessarily a nicer one. I was very resentful about being returned, because dying was just wonderful. Coming back was such crap. And, I mean, really appalling. And I have, a lot of the time, found being here pretty heavy going too. It's just not as nice. It's just hard work, and you're compromised, and it, and when you don't feel well. Anyway, many of you will know exactly what I'm talking about. Everyone will experience it sometime. But there's a lovely thing about that uncovering and uncluttering, which is a quote of Mendelssohn's, which I forever return to, because he didn't quite say this, but he should have. What he should have said, nearly did, was that music is too precise to express in words. And this is the precision of music. It describes these things. Absolutely, we experience it, and we can easily experience it just by listening. You know when you're within the company of someone who's let go in the right way. And you can carry that a long way, as I discovered when, which happened in my career also, and I'm going to shut up in a moment, for reasons that become self-evident. I had the experience once of losing my voice at a critical moment in a tour when we were having a difficult tour on the quartet. So for 5 days I couldn't talk. I should have learnt a lesson. I had to pay, typical, I'm a slow learner, so I had to be sent the hard way. The lesson I should have learnt, which was I realised then, was that I had nothing to add. Everything I was thinking, everything I wanted to say, everything that I would normally adamantly insist upon was said by someone else at the right time for them. I hadn't added anything. Being absent made not a hype of the difference, except everybody proved everyone's mood. And the same thing to a degree happens when you're in intensive care, when you can't speak. Of course, you then have the problem that you can't, you're only heard then by those people whose, what should we call it, level of being is so elevated, I'm talking about carers, that they know your need. And they're fairly rare. But by gum, you recognise them. They come in with a glow around them. I remember there was one nurse in intensive care. As she entered the ward from the other end, I understand why they spoke of the lady of the lamp. She came in and you, suddenly the whole atmosphere was, and she just cared. And she went around the bed, she did small things. One of the things she did, which nobody ever did, because I was paralysed, and I've discussed this before, but I would say it again, the pain of being paralysed is unbelievable. And the relief at having been touched when you cannot move your own limbs, it's like a miracle. She was the only one who ever touched, and all she did was she just moved the bedclothes. There was nothing, no intrusive or anything. It was just love, but it was a loving touch. Well, you hear the same thing on an instrument when somebody has a loving touch. Anyway, I've spoken enough. So, is there anything? What should we talk about?
I love the second simplicity, Paul. And it reminded me of a line that many of you will know from T.S. Eliot, which is the condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything.
That's it. Mm.
That's maybe the second.
He got a pretty long way, didn't he?
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Is there anything to add?
By the way, I do welcome questions, because as long as you've got the energy, I love them.
I wanted to know if Maria was musical and composed to him. Did she share?
Well, there was a program.
The creation of his music.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
This is what I'm talking about. Uh-huh. The program.
I didn't see the program, although. But yeah. Of course, this was the first wife. The second wife was the one who I believe they think may have composed.
Ah, yeah. What was her name?
Magdalena. Anna Magdalena.
That's right. That's.
But I believe that Maria Barbara also did a lot of copying. If you think about it, they didn't have printing and all that stuff. You couldn't print music. So imagine the labor of just producing the parts, and they're flawless.
Ah.
Flawless. The answer is I don't know.
Yeah, the program was about Magdalene.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I think they're much less known about Maria, probably. But, I mean, they had 8 children, for goodness sake. You know. By the way, that was hence the sex mad part of the Viking. You know. Anybody who has 17 children has got to have a pretty healthy libido, let's face it.
Work.
It all depends how you look at it.
Paul, I was listening to Menuhin on one occasion,
yeah.
And I hadn't heard your football story before, and he gave a story, this was on the radio, of his first violin, and he was with a group of people, children, and after he'd been with them, because some of them were playing instruments, he said to his parents that he'd like a violin.
Mm.
And his parents went out and brought him a toy violin.
Yes.
And he stamped on it.
Apparently, Arthur Rubinstein's first present was a violin, and he smashed it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well,
but
he was obviously, in his case, he made a wide choice.
He made a wide choice. But here is a true Curzon, not story, but I've been going to the Leeds International Competition ever since, well, since Radu Loop, who means 40 years. And when Clifford Curzon was on the jury on 3 occasions, after 9 hours of being on the jury, he would practice his dummy keyboard.
Yes.
He always came with a dummy keyboard.
Yes.
And I remember Barenboim once saying that he was quite fastidious about his luggage. I mean, Curzon would come with 6 cases.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, he was a...
Well, most people would come with
man.
One, yes.
Accomplished man, but he also had a wonderful naughtiness about him, by the way, which, very naughty, sometimes quite rude. But I remember, because we played with him towards the end of his life,
right,
and sadly, quite a lot of his friends were dying. So quite a lot of the performances we gave were memorial services. And I remember one for a, it might even come to me, but it won't, not this minute, a particularly famous music critic. And it was quite an august event in one of the London churches. And Clifford said, would you be willing to play? And we said, yeah, sure. And I just remember, we were all perched on this pew at the front of the church, and it was one of these very, well, it would be, it was a po-faced event, you know, it was meant to be, and all of a sudden I found myself launched up into the air about a foot, suddenly shot up like this, and I could hear sniggering alongside, and my quartet were in fits of laughter, you see, and I was sitting there and I couldn't work out what happened, and a few moments later it happened again. And I looked along and I gradually realised that this pew was balanced with legs on the inside and Clifford was at one end, and he discovered that if he pressed down really hard he could shoot me up. And he was he was in such malicious glee, and to show how naughty he was, because he was very much a gentleman, he was a knight after all, he sat there looking impeccable and all this. And as I went up for about the 4th or 5th time, in a stage whisper, he said, Paul, stop mucking about. It's very hard not to love someone like that, isn't it?
Yes.
Paul, I came across you first when you came with the Medici Quartet to Kingston. You were, for a number of years, you were the quartet in residence there, which was a great boon to Kingston at the time, certainly. And I remember, one thing I remember about you was that you always started a concert by explaining the music to us,
yeah.
Which I gather at the time was not the
thing. No, I got criticised in the major...
You were criticised for this, yes, yeah. But I must say, from my point of view, and I think from the point of view of the rest of us there, it was a great benefit, and... I've treasured that, I have to say, in the playing of your quartet there. I was wondering if you've talked about the violin and you played for us a solo, and you talked about Bach's solo work, but of course you didn't, as a quartet, you played Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and the great quartets. I was wondering if you know, without revealing to us too much, if you could say something about what it was to you to play in a quartet as the leader, of course.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it could be a very long story, but I can make it moderately short, just for the moment. The conclusion I came to very much later in the day was I was, if not autistic, I was pretty dysfunctional as a young man. I had no concept of relating to other people whatsoever. To be perfectly honest, I had no interest in relating to other people whatsoever. I fell in love with the Amadeus Quartet, and what I felt I recognised there was a platonic dialogue. And I just so much wanted that. And it seemed so very achievable. So I selected players from the academy in a very dictatorial fashion. They were the best players. And I sort of told them they were in a quartet, which is, to be fair, is the aspiration of all decent string players. And for the first year, we'd work together, and I'd throw them out at lunchtime. And then they'd come back looking very sheepish after lunch. They all went down to the pub. And I'd carry on bullying them. And after about 12 months, we'd made no progress whatsoever. Surprise, surprise. We couldn't play in tune. We couldn't play in time. I thought they were just inept and clearly, you know, but there was nothing better available. And I gradually, because I... as it felt at the time, this is, trying to be as honest as I can, because of the paucity of choice, I thought, well, I'll have to work with the material I've got. It doesn't work telling them what to do, even though it's so self-evident. I was wrong, by the way. You do understand that. I mean, what I was thinking was wrong, but I didn't have any other yardstick to go from. And in desperation, I thought, well, what I'll try and do is I'll try and relate with them. Because maybe they'd be more amenable if they saw me as a friend. So I announced one day I was going to the pub with them. They were absolutely horrified. I mean, it was the one part of the day they actually got any sort of peace, you know. So I went down. I couldn't understand. I still don't understand pub. I mean, it was meaningless to me. And they spoke about things I didn't understand, like football. No interest whatsoever. I mean, why would anyone... Anyway.
Why would anyone kick a bag of wind?
Well, look, I don't think I was right. I mean, clearly I'm wrong, because the whole world is in love with these things. And also, they must see things I don't see in it. And very, very gradually, I kind of manipulated them round to seeing me as an ally. But I'll be honest, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say. It was done at that level of thought. And then, of course, because we travelled together, I was obliged to listen to the cricket. And I actually fell in love with the cricket. Not because of the cricket, but because of there was John Arlott and people like that. And I detected this kind of a camaraderie and a wittiness and a, you know, there was something, and there was like a tradition, and there was a gentleness, and very slowly we began, and also at the same time we began to sort of create sutures of ensemble. But what I realised much later was that actually what I'd always missed, always wanted, hadn't been able to articulate or understood, was I wanted siblings, I wanted a family. So that's what I got, is I got a family, God help me. And of course, I then also discovered why you might want to not have a family. Does that make any sense?
This may be a personal question, but I'll ask it anyway because I'm curious. I'm a palliative care doctor, so I've seen many people dying. And I had one patient telling me his near-death experience, which again was very positive. Like you said, yours is positive.
But we
Oh, and there's another one, the rescue one coming to.
We often say that people don't die because they can't let go.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Well, he's the man, really. Yeah.
They don't let go. So it's interesting that you talk about how it is to play the violin and letting go. And I don't know, maybe you've spoken about your near-death experience. I don't know.
I have, and I've tried to write about it.
Yeah.
I mean, we should listen to Peter on this, but I'll give you my own little insight.
I know First Peter all, has done research in the same hospice that I work,
uh-huh,
so
okay.
I've heard you.
Well, first of all, I've got to say, and I'm not trying to, I've only died once. No, I'm saying that quite seriously, because it seems to me that it's quite likely that depending on how you die, is how you die. You know, I mean, what happened to me is I was basically bleeding to death internally, for whatever reason, because I know it's not universal, but in my case, that made me feel very delicious and kind of, it's like floating down a river in a punt and just looking, I just floated. As long as nobody asked anything of me, I was more than happy to float away. And then when the time came that I did float over the edge, what was the waiting was so beautiful. It was a complete solace, and it had a simplicity that I've never found in life. I think it could be that if you're dying in pain, or maybe I was dying in pain. I don't know what I was. I mean, you know more about it than I do. Was I suffering pain?
Probably. Certainly in the near-death experience, as you pull away from the body, and the sensations you have are just like you described. When you come back into the body, at whatever point you come back into the body, then you come back into this excruciating
pain. Oh, it's pretty rough.
It's very rough, and it's got the other component is it's from an expansion down into a contraction, and it's both of those which are so enormously painful.
I did find that.
Yes.
Unacceptable. I think I actually believe that's why I stayed in coma so long. I really just. I say I. This is. I've been trying to write about this, and I have a wonderful editor, and we're thrashing about this. We've spent like 6 months over this now, because she keeps saying, "So you were there to make a decision,"
no.
And I keep saying, "No, I wasn't there. How can you be there when you're dead? You know, I didn't exist." But a decision was being made that I was somehow participant in, and I do know that I didn't want to return. Partly because on those odd occasions that I would write, it was literally like rising to the surface. The sense of disturbance and of fear, and not in an articulate way, but there was this sense of, my God, you're so damaged. Do you even want to go? No, I don't want to go there. Why would I want to go there? You'd be mad to go there.
It's really interesting. Many of you will have read even Alexander's book, and Proof of Heaven. And he had meningitis in fact. Ibn Alexander's book, Proof of Heaven, and he did exactly the same thing. He went away, went into what he calls the core, which is very much a similar description to that you've given. Then he would come back again. Then he'd be gripped by this absolute horror. And then he would decide, no, he didn't want to go back. And so he would float back towards the core again. And there was this dialogue between him and the core, or between him and the universal, as to whether, in fact, he was going to leave or not. And that was exactly what you were doing. And the whole idea of, is it you who makes a decision? No, it isn't. It's a decision arises, but arises in a dialogue.
Yes, that's what it feels like. And but I wouldn't even care to say who the dialogue's between.
Oh, no, you can't do that. Sometimes you can. Sometimes it will be put into a godlike figure, or it will be into another figure that you're familiar with. But sometimes it won't. It'll be just the dialogue arising. Should one, in fact, go back, or should one not go back? And it's not often that you hear the description, which is yours, that... Oh, my God, I'm so damaged. I'm not sure I want to go back. Usually,
if that occurs, then there is also the information given that you're so damaged, but you have something to do. You've got to go back. But that wasn't so in your case.
Can I just say something which is interesting? The night before, or the day before Paul came out of his coma, the surgeon came up to me and said, Mrs. Robertson, we have done everything we can. He was saying to me, we can't do any more. Just accept it. And I don't know what made me say it, but I just said, I could hear the words coming out of my mouth, but we can pray. And, you know, this was a marvelous man, but there was not a flicker of emotion until I said that, and his eyes lit up, and he said, yes, prayer is very powerful, and we must always remember that. And that evening, I went back about midnight, opened up the emails, and for some reason, they came pouring in, Peninsula Med School, where Paul was a professor. They'd all gotten together, and they said, we're going to pray for Paul. Just all around the world, they were praying, and the next morning, he woke up.
Mm. Amazing. Yes, thank you, Chika. And it's not uncommon for people to get around the bed and pray, and the person will come back. Obviously, if you're actually dying, it's different. But in the near-death experience, where you've been seriously ill, then prayer can certainly touch the process, alter the process, and you'll come back. Mm. Paul, it's 10 o'clock.
Yeah, you want to go to bed?
No, I wasn't thinking of that one bit. I was wondering if you wanted to get to bed.
Well, I probably... the answer is I ought to go to bed, but this is the first outing I've had for... And you know what? It's just great. I think you... How can I put this? It's very reaffirming just, A, to have people to speak with who have some understanding of what, you know, because by and large, people haven't got a clue.
Yes.
You know, exactly. Or we don't have an environment where the clue is could be, you understand what I mean? And I miss that. You get lonely when you kind of come back.
Yes. Yes, you do. And usually you get lonely because you have changed. Therefore, a lot of the things that you used to be able to do aren't the same
anymore. No, that seems to be true.
And so you're much more isolated when you come back.
Mm, that's quite a powerful feeling, I'd say.
Yes. Mm. Well, we're going to have to let you go.
Okay. I was never very good at taking hints, was I? So
Paul, the second simplicity. Thank you so much. Let's thank Paul again.